This is January 22nd, 2017, and today I want to address the very, very important matter of habit and character and karma, how they're all related. My mind turned in this to this topic with the term intensive, our winter term intensive, having just gotten underway a few days ago. For those of you who don't know, very briefly, we have this twice a year. It's a period of several weeks where people who want to participate pledge to do something or not do something, basically, in order to break a habit or initiate a healthy, wholesome routine. They all involve discipline, self-discipline, and getting back to work on oneself. In Zen, we see the all-important link in this is our thoughts, the degree to which we can move through our lives unencumbered by thoughts, random, irrelevant thoughts that clutter the mind. And you might say that sort of the theme of this Taisho is, I could say, sum up in a word, some words of the Buddha. He said, thought manifests as word, word manifests as deed, deed develops into habit, habit hardens into character. So that causal chain, thought, deeds or actions, habit, and character. What we're doing in meditation is to go right to the source of this process of character development, which is the managing of the mind through our attention or our inattention. That's just a little preview of what we'll get into now. Let me start from an article from a book review from the New York Times book review section. This is actually from 3 or 4 years ago. It's a review of a book called The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. And it's written by Charles Duhigg, D-U-H-I-G-G. The name of the review, the title of the review is Can't Help Myself. I look at the science of how we form habits and how we break them. I'll read a bit from the review. The review is by Timothy Wilson, who is a professor of psychology, and he's the author of a book called Redirect, The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. All right, so he begins. Human consciousness, that wonderful ability to reflect, ponder, and choose, is our greatest evolutionary achievement. But it is possible to have too much of a good thing, and fortunately, we also have the ability to operate on automatic pilot, performing complex behaviors without any conscious thought at all. One way this happens is with lots of practice. Tasks that seem impossibly complex at first, like learning how to play the guitar, speak a foreign language, or operate a new DVD player, become second nature after we perform those actions many times. And then he has in parentheses, well, maybe not the DVD player. And then he quotes William James as saying, if practice did not make perfect, nor habit economize the expense of nervous and muscular energy, we would be in a sorry plight. So that's just sort of the efficiency of this body-mind complex is developing these learning things that help us and enrich our lives. Just a thought here. Tasks, we read tasks that seem impossibly complex at first. Well, we consider sitting, zazen, meditation, the same sort of thing. It can be so, seems so formidably difficult at first. But, of course, through practice, doing it on a daily basis, we learn how to do it more effectively. Then he goes on, but of course there is a dark side to habits, namely that we acquire bad ones, like smoking or overeating. I imagine that most people, except perhaps for a friend of mine who said in reaction to a news story about the dangers of hypertension, I've given up all my vices, please don't take away my salt. Most people would love to find an easy way of breaking a bad habit or two. And then the reviewer mentions this book, The Power of Habit. And it's based on hundreds of scientific papers and interviews of scientists who wrote them. And the book relays interesting findings on habit formation and change from the fields of social psychology, clinical psychology, and neuroscience. This is not a self-help book conveying one author's homespun remedies, but a serious look at the science of habit formation and change. Duhigg is optimistic about how we can put the science to use. Once you understand that habits can change, he concludes, you have the freedom and the responsibility to remake them. Once you understand that habits can be rebuilt, the power becomes easier to grasp, and the only option left is to get to work. Well, this goes right to the core of Zen practice, too. If we couldn't change our habits and our character, then there'd be no point to practice. We do it in order to change. Change is never as fast as we would like, but no real, enduring, meaningful change happens quickly. That's just a law of life we have to accept. It takes time to undo what we have formed in ourselves. Time and persistence. He also suggests that by understanding the nature of habits, we can influence group behavior, turning companies into profit makers and ensuring the success of social movements. And this is certainly true at in any groups, including Zen centers or any other spiritual centers. We acquire through these four this progression of four things: thoughts, actions, habits, and character. We acquire a kind of a group character, a collective character. And it's one of the very interesting and illuminating things about traveling on pilgrimage, going to other Zen centers or Buddhist centers in Asia or even here, is to see how different the different centers are, the temples or monasteries. The Japanese have a phrase for this. They call it the wind of the house. And at the same center, the wind of the house can shift over time, I think it's in some ways different now here after 50 years, after our 50 years, than it was in the earlier days. And it will be somewhat different in the future, of course. It's just the nature of change. And then I'm skipping a few paragraphs here. Unfortunately, the reviewer says, it's not always clear from Duhigg's book how we should boil down these examples into a prescription for change, because he combines markedly different behaviors at the individual and societal levels into the rubric of habits. Okay, let me just say, you want a prescription for change? Sit. That's it. Sit every day. Come to Sesshin when you can. That's it. That's the prescription. There may be many other secondary things you can do, and I'm sure the book explores these, but that goes to the root of it. In the first chapter, he presents a simple scheme called the habit loop, whereby an environmental cue automatically leads to a behavioral routine that results in a reward. So, for example, with eating, overeating, or eating the wrong things, the cue can be just seeing the thing, or having it open in front of you, and that's why, in order to change that particular habit, it can help so much to just keep things out of sight. He sticks to this scheme throughout, that is, the habit loop scheme, using it as a framework to understand such diverse behaviors as why people buy a certain brand of toothpaste, why people become addicted to cigarettes and alcohol, and why people prefer particular songs on the radio. And then he offers a critique. The danger of trying to explain so much with one framework, that is, the habit loop, is that it sidesteps crucial distinctions about why people behave mindlessly, distinctions we need to understand if we want to change those behaviors. I heard a piece on NPR once about habit formation. It may have been an interview with or a discussion maybe of this book. And in it, I thought it was so well put that I scribbled it down. This was a few years ago. In time, we come to deposit parts of ourselves in our environment, and those parts then dictate who we are. Or as Sun Tzu said it in Affirming Faith and Mind, for things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. Here again we have, in our tradition, going to the root of it all. Our the mind and our environment are co-determining of things. Continues, one way behavior can become habitual is through repetition, of course. If we acquire a bad habit this way, it is very hard to change because its grooves are so well worn in our minds. We have to painstakingly practice a better response that wears a new groove. Duhigg gives the example of the success of the former NFL coach Tony Dungy, who, with lots and lots of practice, taught his players a small number of important moves they could perform without thinking, even at the most crucial point in a game. Bad habits are overcome by learning new routines and practicing them over and over again. It's the same with sitting. The longer we sit, the more it becomes kind of second nature to us, the more we can trust and relax into the body and allow the body to settle. Once we get through the initial stages of working out our posture, our little repertoire of postures that we rotate through, then we can sort of forget about consciously working with the body and just allow the body to settle. And when that happens, the mind more readily settles. It's always the challenge with anything new, I suppose, but certainly with Zen practice, is getting through the initial few weeks, maybe months, and to the point where we learn to integrate the different features of proper sitting, and that's when things become easier. He continues, but then there are compulsions and addictions, behaviors that involve dependence on a chemical substance like nicotine or alcohol, or behaviors that have become so rewarding that they're nearly impossible to resist. For example, gambling. As many wrecked families can attest, these habits are the hardest to change. Unfortunately, there is no magic bullet, though intensive treatments and social support can work. I think of 12-step programs and how powerful they can be if you commit to them, if you stick with them. There's no question but that maybe millions of people have seen change for the better by committing to meetings and over time finding that they can change that habit, whatever that habit is of you trying to unravel. Social support. This is where sitting with others can be so helpful in overcoming bad habits and setting down new, cutting new grooves that are the work for oneself, for one's own welfare. Other behaviors are habitual because they obey social norms, norms that we rarely question or think about. We shake hands when we greet people, wear socks of the same color. Although I can tell you from Doksan, that's not always the case. And eat with a fork because these are the customs we have learned. Such behaviors are not well-worn grooves in our minds, but actions we could easily alter if the laws or customs that govern them should change. One of the delightful norms in Mexico that are different from here is how kind of reflexively people will shake hands every day. Someone you work with in the same office, you greet them in the morning. You don't just say hello or good morning. You shake hands, and there's this this sort of routine that I've seen many times in public, where first there's the handshake, the conventional handshake. And there's the embrace, and then part three is the kind of higher, what do you call this, where you hold your hands up like this. It's beautiful. It's just so natural, so fluid, this three-part greeting. And I've had a hard time not importing that here to the United States because it's embodying a greeting. It's not just saying it in words, but you're engaging the body in it. But we always have to be aware of when something would be seen as make people uncomfortable. But I think I'm almost sure that it's becoming slowly acceptable in the United States to do more frequent handshaking like this. You can tell so much about a person by shaking their hand, whether it's too weak or too strong. Then he mentions in the review how these norms can change. He says in 1984, 86% of people failed to buckle up their seatbelts. By 2010, this habit, which he puts in quotes, this habit had flipped such that 85% of people now wore seatbelts. This change did not involve learning a new routine, as happens when people spend hundreds of hours learning a musical instrument. After all, people already knew how to grab the belt and insert the buckle into the receptacle. Rather, it happened because of changing norms in our society, spurred on by legislation in some states. In fact, social psychologists have shown that an effective way of changing many habitual behaviors is to change people's perceptions of the norms that govern them, resulting in reduced drinking on college campuses, for instance, and lowered energy use in the home. We're at a point now where the norm of what is acceptable speech and what isn't has suddenly taken an about face. Thanks to our new president, I think largely to him, speech that a year ago would have been considered bad, wrong, hurtful, is now making a comeback. That's shows you how fluid norms are. Societal norms are not fixed; they can shift back and forth. And now we see slurs of all kinds: racial slurs, ethnic slurs, gender slurs, religious slurs, as in some quarters as being more acceptable and therefore more frequently happening. It's very troubling because just as thoughts form speech, speech forms habit, and habit forms character. The in that four-part chain, the part that is most easily worked with and changed and remade or undone is at the level of thoughts, but then speech is the next most important place to apply oneself in changing it. He continues, there's another type of habitual behavior that involves more cognitive activity, namely people's interpretation of a situation according to what it means for them and how it fits into the narratives they tell themselves. Now we're getting into the real, more deeply ingrained character issues. These behaviors are habitual in the sense that people have chronic ways of interpreting the world. Yeah, this is right at the heart of Buddhist teaching, that that what we call reality, and this is backed up by mounting evidence in neuroscience, what we call reality is our interpretation of reality. And there can be a very broad consensus where many people see reality the same way, but still It is based on a template of the mind, filters, sort of neurological filters, which themselves are based on habits, habitual ways of thinking. So prejudice, for example, operates on this level, where our perceptions are based on our often unconscious biases. This goes right to the heart of racism, where people who claim to have no racial bias don't know their minds. How can you claim that what they're doing is denying the unconscious? How can you claim to not have what could be unconscious? It's really a lack of sophistication, lack of understanding of how insidious, how deceptive the mind can be. We're all subject to this, these unconscious biases. These behaviors, he continues, are habitual in the sense that people have chronic ways of interpreting the world. A black college student's story, that's in quotation marks, for example, may be that she doesn't belong at the majority white university she attends, which causes her to fall into a pattern of disengagement and academic failure. Research shows that changing black students' stories about their sense of belonging improves their academic performance and health throughout college. And just to, one way to change that is through our own reactions, our own biases toward, in this case, toward black students. I'm switching to another article now. This is from, I need a clock, John. This is from an issue of Shambhala Sun. It's now called Lion's Roar. It's one of the three main national Buddhist magazines that I'm aware of. Lion's Roar, Tricycle, and Buddha Dharma. And this one is by a very popular Buddhist teacher in Theravadan Buddhism or Vipassana Buddhism, Sylvia Boorstein. And she talks about five styles of habitual reaction and how to free yourself from yours. I'll start off with the anecdote because it's very encompasses all five of these habitual styles of reactions. She says, Emily, a longtime participant in my regular Wednesday morning Buddhist class, told us about a distressing experience she'd had the previous day. I couldn't believe it, she said. I came out of my apartment building and there was my car just where I'd left it the night before, but lower. All the tires had been stolen. I got so upset that I walked the three blocks to Macy's and bought the silk pajamas I'd been coveting. People laughed sympathetically, just as we did. People laughed sympathetically, acknowledging Emily's discomfort and appreciating the unexpected remedy she'd chosen. After that, Emily continued, I went home and called the police. Another person in that group said, I'm surprised you went shopping. I would have found the building manager and given her a piece of my mind. I pay high rent to have good security. I probably would have been in a bad mood all day. It always takes time for my mind to settle down. Someone else said, I feel like I can't tolerate that kind of sudden stress. When something like that happens, I feel exhausted before I even start to deal with it. I would have gone into my apartment, called work, and told them I needed the rest of the day off. Someone else said, well, you people know what a worrier I am. I would have thought, today the tires, tomorrow the car. When I get over one worry, my mind is quickly scanning for the next possible thing to worry about. Finally, someone said, my mind doesn't do any of those things. It blames. Mostly it blames me. It is as if I have a built-in peer review committee always ready to criticize. I wonder who appointed them. By this time, we were all laughing, realizing we had accidentally put together a list of the traditional five afflictive energies. These are five habitual ways people react to challenging circumstances that cloud clear judgment. I think the last time I gave a teisho on these, they're also called the five hindrances, the five afflictive energies. They're a good, solid, broad way of understanding what one's vulnerabilities are under stress. And I'm just going to take a little time to go on with this article. So these five that we just went through present the vulnerability of desire, the vulnerability of aversion, that is all of the forms of anger, annoyance, rage, the vulnerability of sloth and torpor, as it's usually called, that of restlessness, which manifests as fretting or worrying, and that of doubt, which is linked with insecurity, self-blame, and lack of confidence. Just to read a bit more from Sylvia Boorstein, when I tell the story about this class, it usually elicits an enthusiastic response. Yes, that's me. Matter of fact, I have two of those five response patterns. Can a person have more than one? In fact, I respond, we each have all those habitual patterns of response in varying combinations in response to different circumstances. On one notable occasion, though, a man who had recently joined the class said, I don't understand any of this. I would have phoned my work to tell them I'd be late, then I would have phoned the police, my insurance company, and an auto repair to get the car towed and serviced. Then I would have taken the bus to work. What's the matter with these people? Everyone laughed, and I probably did too, but I was very careful in my response because no one had been wrong in identifying how they responded to stress, and nothing was the matter with anyone. I replied, I think most of us here would have done that too. What people are describing is what they felt like doing, what thoughts flashed through their minds before they did the obvious sensible thing. The silk pajama story served as a prompt for people to notice what their minds habitually bring up in response to stress and difficulty. And then she very generously shares her own vulnerability, the restlessness one of worrying and fretting. And she says, my most prominent default position, the one that's been the most painful all my life, is restlessness, an agitation of mind that manifests as obsessive worrying, or you could say ruminating. Long before I knew about restlessness as a recognizable, commonly shared form of confusion, I knew I had it. I worried about things that were sometimes genuine concerns, which required attention but not obsessive fretting, and I worried about imagined concerns, things that had not yet happened but could. So let's just go through these five again, because these are from the time of the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, where he outlined these, and we can, I think, agree that human nature hasn't drastically altered in that time, or arguably hasn't altered much at all, because these five defaults are still, I think, really applicable and helpful. I think that the key thing is to know the enemy, know what you're up against, and maybe for each one of us, there's one of these five that is more challenging, more habitually rooted in our reactions to the environment, to stress. Number one, well, one and two are sort of the twin afflictions that we read about most in Buddhism, desire and aversion. What I like, what I don't like. Desire can be lusting after sensual pleasure, grasping after sense objects, sense experiences, or even non-sensual mind states. Desire keeps the mind looking outward, looking at something, grasping at something. It can even be grasping at some future experience in practice, grasping for awakening. People new to Zen and Buddhism often find fault with this as a problem, because they say, this is what I've heard so often at workshops. Now, wait a minute. Are you saying that I'm not supposed to want anything? I'm not supposed to have any desires? No, that would be absurd. We have desires. As human beings, we are wired to want things and people and experiences. The problem, from a Buddhist perspective, is when we're attached to that desire, when it owns us, it possesses us. That's where, and besides, it's not that we say desires are bad or wrong. It's just that they cause us suffering. Others too, maybe, but certainly ourselves. That's the problem. Not a moral issue. It's that we bind ourselves to suffering if we are attached to our desires, or to the degree that we're attached to our desires. Until we deal with our clinging and our grasping, we remain bound by these forces of attachment and possession. That's all. That's what Buddhism is. It's just a way to free ourselves from bondage, to unshackle ourselves from these things. The wanting, craving mind is painful because it keeps us from the present, keeps us from being present. We're always looking ahead or outside ourselves. And this craving mind distorts and limits our perception and our judgment. So that's number one, desire. Number two, aversion, is there anything that, anger, annoyance, irritation, hatred, ill will, rage, all those ones, and then also fear, judging other people, critical of other people, critical of ourselves. Even boredom is a state of aversion, something we don't like. This goes back to that, liking and disliking. There's another construct that I think can be very useful in terms of self-knowledge, which is the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. And there's this useful metaphor, I think, again, in terms of understanding one's vulnerabilities, of walking in a room. You walk in a room, there are people there, and those who are susceptible to the first of the three poisons, greed in its many forms, tends to operate on the basis of what you can get out of that room and those people, how you can get something for yourself. by working the crop, working the people in the room, or something else. The second type, the aversion type, when they walk into a room, they're more likely to find fault with people, find fault with the room, the way it's decorated, or anything, the quality of the air, or anything else. And the third type, the delusion, greed, anger, and delusion, the third type is people who would more commonly just feel disoriented or confused. Anyway, moving along, the third of the five hindrances is variously characterized as sloth, torpor, laziness of mind, sluggishness, sleepiness, fogginess. That's one that who wouldn't recognize that from time to time. The fourth is restlessness. She mentioned that one. Agitation, anxiety. And the fifth is doubt. The fifth is the most crippling, because the first four we can all be dissolved bit by bit through practice. The fifth one threatens to stop our practice. If we have doubt about the practice, doubt about ourselves, doubt about the teacher, those kinds of things, then we're really facing the most serious threat to change. In just a little while, we're having a funeral service here, and I just want to relate all of this, thoughts, actions, habits, and character to the purpose of a funeral service and a memorial service. Based on how we use or misuse the mind, our attention, this manifests as it will find its way to express itself in our words. And our words, our speech, then develops into habits, and habits become character. Yasutani Roshi said, Zen practice is all about the refinement of human character. But the word character comes very close to karma. We are forming and reforming our karma with every action and thought that we have. It's happening all the time, moment by moment by moment by moment. This the character of ourselves, our character, is shifting all the time. It's mostly fairly fixed, you know, because of habits, but there's always some chance of change. And then when we die, when the physical body passes, then our karma, or the character of the character that is formed, doesn't. This is the Buddhist viewpoint of it, which you can take or leave. In Zen, you practice Zen your whole life and not have to buy into this, but it seems so plausible, doesn't it? Doesn't it seem plausible that we are forming character all the time, and that the longer we go doing the same thing, saying the same thing, thinking the same thing, reacting the same ways, the more firmly that character gets into place. And then at the death of the body, it's not that just disappears, that there is a momentum. That's another word for karma. There's a momentum behind it that then extends into one's next lifetime. All right, so I'll say a little bit more of that about that before the funeral service at 11 o'clock this morning. But for now, our time is up, and we'll recite the four vows. all beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I